Welcome to the Holden Village Podcast. Holden is a community of education, programming, and worship located in the remote wilderness of the Cascade Mountains. These snapshots provide a glimpse into the learnings taking place in our community. Let's tune in to this week's highlight.
My name is Ian Goler. I'm the utilities lead here at Holden Village. Prior to coming up here, I was finishing up a master's program in environmental engineering, looking at water treatment, wastewater treatment, hydropower generation. I was studying all of that in school. And then I visited my mom here over a spring break and was way more excited about getting to tinker with all of those systems. So getting to do that in a very hands-on fashion was a much more appealing prospect to me than going into consulting. The other big part of my role is our heat, which is kind of tied into the water system and power system a little bit. And then within operations, I mean, especially now that the village is in this COVID lockdown, small village kind of state, we're all pitching out to help each other. So I do a little bit of repairs, a little bit of mechanic stuff occasionally, just whatever needs doing. On a good day, there's very little that I actually have to do in the utilities world. Everything is running smoothly, and I don't have to fix anything. I do what's called rounds, the one thing that every day someone absolutely has to do. And that's kind of split between having to do it based on legal responsibility, which is all of our drinking water, and having to do it just based on making sure that critical infrastructure stays functioning. Mm-hmm. So every day for rounds, the process, I walk out to the water treatment plant. I have to check out the chlorine levels in our drinking water, both in the village and at the water treatment plant. That's just for reporting to the Department of Health. So that's a legal requirement. I also check on how well our water filters are doing. If our water filters get too gunked up, then I have to change them out. Just replace them with clean filters. I'll adjust how much water is going through the plant at any given time, things like that. It's just making a lot of small adjustments aside from like our basic chlorine testing, just to make sure that we have a sufficient amount of chlorine in our water to meet state health standards.
So that's probably the biggest outside pressure.
Yeah.
In terms of day-to-day checking.
Definitely.
There's nothing like that with the power?
No, not really. We have a permit that we have to pay once a year to maintain our water usage rights for Copper Creek. All of our hydroelectric power is us taking water from Copper Creek, funneling it down the penstock, which is a giant, like 14-inch set of pipe, and then running it through our electric turbines. We have to maintain our water rights to that, which is some, like, for as important as the hydro is to the village, we pay so little. Can't remember the exact amount, but it's on the order of a couple hundred dollars per year to get electricity for the village year-round.
What are the things that aren't so environmentally friendly that we've got still going, maybe in the future can be adjusted or replaced? Or
it's something that we've, across ops, have been kind of trying to take an inventory of. So another like minor part of my job is tracking our fuel usage, and that kind of gets distributed across ops. But really, burning fossil fuels is still our number one source of carbon footprint in the village. Mm-hmm. Depending on where you draw the system boundary, it becomes a larger or smaller problem. So if you restrict it to just village activities and don't take into account the boat and needing that for all of our food and shipping everything up here, you could make the system boundary very big and argue that there's no way that Holden will ever be carbon neutral. Within the village, we do a very, very good job of reducing our carbon footprint because all of our electricity comes from hydropower. And then all of our heating is either hydropower electricity or what we call stoking, so burning wood to heat our boilers. The main sources where we're not carbon neutral are for running transport, getting the buses or trucks up and down the road to pick things up from Lucerne or whatever else. That's probably our biggest source of emissions at the moment. We also burn quite a lot of propane in the kitchen, which is something that we're looking at ways to offset. Occasionally, we'll burn fuel for heating, although a lot of work that my predecessor, August Kramer, did is really helping to move us away from using fossil fuels for heating. Last fall, like right when I came in, a big project that we were working on was to tie the hotel into one of our wood-fired boiler systems. So
Lodge 6?
Yeah. We can heat the hotel. So there's a big wood stove in the basement of Lodge 6, which heats. It supplies water to the radiators in Lodge 6, Lodge 1, and the hotel. And the hotel used to be diesel fueled for all of its heat. That's a large reduction in the amount of fossil fuel that we have to use. And we're looking at ways to keep tying in other buildings to that heat system so that at least our heating can completely go off of any sort of fossil fuel use.
Which buildings are still heated by propane or diesel? Is it diesel too?
It's diesel for heat. Agape is the only one. And even then, Agape can mostly be heated by electricity. If we have really low electricity, just because we're not getting a lot of water from Copper Creek in the dead of winter, we'll switch over to diesel for Agape. But most of the time, Agape is able to run on electric.
So speaking about the lowest electricity given frozen Copper Creek, how low has it gone? And personally, I've never lived in a place where I've had such a awareness of my energy use affecting other people directly. And we'd all be better off on a global scale if we had that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Because things are so removed and, oh, it's unlimited. Just plug in your electronics. I mean, ultimately, you are drawing from resources. So what's the lowest, since you've been here, it's gotten down to kilowatt generation? And what are some of the things that we have to do as a village to adjust to that really low power?
Yeah. Like you said, it's a really unique circumstance where we live in a place, if you turn your dryer on, you could cause a power outage. It's pretty wild. Within my time here, last winter, I think we got down into the 30 kilowatt range for what we had available. Just for reference, the village laundry has very large dryers. Any one of those dryers by themselves can pull 30 kilowatts. It is a very low amount of power. Those are not like your standard home dryers, but still, we have a single appliance in the village that can use the village's entire power supply in the dead of winter.
We switch to propane then?
Yeah. So okay. A lot of the time we'll use propane dryers, which I guess is another source of fossil fuel use that's going to be hard to get around. We also have a lot of infrastructure that people much smarter than me put into place. We have a system called the load controller, which is a computerized system that monitors and controls our power usage. I've talked to folks who worked in utilities before me, and they said that the number of power outages that we had in winters prior to getting the load control system installed was so much higher than it is now. Because anymore, that load controller can just switch off a lot of the biggest loads in the village. When you're thinking about power usage, anything that's generating heat is going to use a lot more power than most other stuff. Like, people always talk about turning off your light bulbs, but compared to your toaster, your curling irons, your dryers, that sort of thing, anything that generates heat uses a lot of power, water heaters, and the load controller is tied into a lot of those big loads over the computer network. So it gets into some complicated electrical engineering, essentially, but it monitors the frequency of the current that we're getting. If the frequency starts to get too low, it'll shut off some of the big loads that we have around the village, like people's water heaters, the heating elements in some of the boilers, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that we're never trying to use more power than we can generate.
Do you know anything about the reason why, like, the energy doesn't mess with our electronics and our laptops? I mean, this is a totally random question, but, you know, the lights occasionally dim in my house, but it doesn't, like, short circuit my computer. I think that has to do with my own adapter plugged into the wall, that has a way to regulate a constant supply of electricity. But the village must have some sort of conditioner or something.
The short answer is no, we don't have some sort of conditioner, and it does actually mess with electronics.
It does.
Yeah.
Like an example?
Well, one example that I just learned when I came here and thought was really interesting was that none of our electric clocks run correctly. In the winter, most of the electric clocks on stoves and things will run really slow because they keep time according to the 60 hertz electrical current that they're supposed to be getting, but instead they're getting something like 59.5 a lot of the time, so they just gradually lose time. Same thing in the summer, a lot of the time they'll run fast because they're starting to get 60.5 hertz. And then as far as more like complicated electronics, I don't know as much about that side of things. I have definitely heard that the village's power supply is not good for electronics. Things with power adapters are probably pretty safe, and I think that's a large part of why it doesn't fry your computer. But at the same time, most sensitive electronics that require a really narrow voltage range, the lifespan of those electronics is often shortened.
Interesting.
And again, I don't know a huge amount about it. I might just be spouting hearsay.
Can you explain a little bit about the Dante heating loop system?
Yeah. Dante specifically is one of three boilers that we have, but it's definitely the one that gets the most recognition because it heats almost everybody's homes in the village. The Dante loop is actually three separate loops, but roughly speaking, it heats Narnia, which is our school, and then Shelley's 1 through 7. But the basic idea behind that whole system is that we have the boiler, which is, when I say boiler, I basically just mean glorified massive fireplace. It's a really large box that we can either, if we have enough electricity, it has water heater elements in heat the water inside of
it. It's a little misleading because you're not actually boiling water.
We come pretty close. There have been times that we've boiled water.
Right, but then that becomes a problem.
Yeah, it's not good if we're boiling water because then you lose all of the water.
But yeah, some radiators are actually steam, but not in our village.
Not here.
So, explain what goes through the radiators.
So we just have water flowing through our radiators, and that water then gets heated off of the boiler.
To what temperature?
It really depends.
Right. If somebody is doing a good job in the winter stoking, what's the ideal temperature you want to keep the water at?
180 degrees is about what we try to get up to overnight. That then supplies water to the radiators in all of the buildings. That's probably on the order of 140 to 150 degrees.
Okay.
Give or take.
Okay.
And that then circulates through all of the radiators and keeps them nice and toasty.
Is there any plan of expanding to chalets that aren't on the loop?
It is a goal, but we haven't started doing any serious design for it. Dante itself, that boiler, is probably pretty close to capacity. Like, we probably wouldn't be able to heat any more buildings terribly efficiently off of that boiler. The pipe dream is to create a second Dante loop, one where we can do the same thing that Dante is doing, but circulate water to Agape and then chalets 8 through 14 would be the goal.
So having another boiler,
maybe
up above the garden or something, or
and
a whole new wood storage.
That is quite a lot of work. And also involves some legal dealings with the Forest Service just based on where we're allowed to build and what we're allowed to build. And there are a lot of steps that would be necessary in that process. Like I said, it's kind of a pipe dream at this point. It might happen in the future, but I am not expecting it in the time that I'm here.
How does the carbon footprint work in terms of all of the wood that we use?
The basic idea and why we argue that it's more carbon neutral to get our heat from wood rather than diesel is the distinction between what's called short cycle and long cycle carbon. So wood is what's considered a short cycle carbon because trees are pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. When you burn wood, it's functioning on a much shorter kind of time scale with regard to circulating that CO2 than, say, diesel is, where the time scale on which carbon gets stored in fossil fuels is thousands of years as opposed to a couple decades.
I see.
So it's still not ideal, but it's a heck of a lot better. What it comes down to.
What about the future plans of getting more hydroelectric power from perhaps Railroad Creek? That's a hope. I mean, in terms of redundancy, we don't have something that if hydro broke, we'd have to go to a diesel immediately.
Yes. We do have two hydro generators, which is helpful. So,
but they're both running, aren't they?
No.
Oh, really?
We only run one generator at a time.
Okay, so that's redundant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which, there are still issues in the system. Really, the concern is the D dam, the diversion dam, where we take all of the water from Copper Creek. Uh-huh. There's kind of redundancy for the D dam, but it's not good. That is the most vulnerable point in that system.
Given that things could clog it, or what?
Things could clog it. An avalanche could just take out
the whole building.
The whole building. Yeah. A tree could hit it. The D dam is definitely our weakest point in our power supply.
But it's been going since, what, the 70s or
60s?
Okay.
I think the current iteration of the D dam is more recent. I have not really been involved in the conversations about installing another generator on Railroad Creek. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a possibility.
That's something for the SciTech.
Yeah, we have other folks with more design experience working on that. As far as I'm aware, the goals behind that have more to do with providing more hydroelectric power to the valley as a whole, probably more specifically IMCO than the village.
Yeah, because they're all diesel.
Yeah, and their water treatment process uses quite a lot of power.
I do remember learning that your master's program in the environmental engineering was more computer-related and software, and now here you have to come and actually fix things. And just in terms of the on-the-job learning that has had to take place, it makes me kind of scared some days to think, are they just Googling things like in terms of like how to fix problems that come up?
The answer is yes. We are absolutely Googling things on a regular basis for how to fix stuff. Coming up here, I had a good amount of theoretical background on how these systems worked and how to manage them, and approximately no hands-on experience. So it still boggles my mind sometimes that they let me have this job. Because in terms of what I actually do day-to-day here, it is so much more hands-on than when you're studying fluid dynamics equations. That's great, but it doesn't teach you how to fix a pump when your heat system doesn't work.
Right.
There's been quite a lot of on-the-job learning, and that's continued the entire time that I've been here. The first winter I was here, our heat system just worked. It didn't have any problems basically the whole winter. And now this winter, I've spent the last 2 weeks sorting out basically every problem that I could imagine knock on wood, for the Dante loop, because we had an issue where the circulating pipe sprung a leak in the system. So we were just draining all of the water that was supposed to go to the radiators that was getting drained into the basement of Chalet 1. And thus, none of the radiators all the way up Chalet Hill had any heat until we found where we were draining all of that water. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of issues with airlocked radiators. You have to push all of the air out of that Dante loop. All kinds of different details that are not things that you cover when you're looking at very idealized circumstances. And
so given that the hands-on experience was next to nothing, you said, coming in, you did overlap with the past utilities guy, August. Are there extensive turnover files?
There are extensive turnover files. The degree to which they are helpful with solving problems as they arise is spotty.
Okay.
Sometimes they're extremely helpful.
Right.
If you have a person who has run into the same problem that you have and has written a document on what they did, that's great. That happens maybe 10% of the time. It's something that I've tried to be better about, just for the sake of helping people down the line, is anytime I run into a new problem, just write up, here's what I encountered, here's what I did, here's what worked, here's what didn't work. It's definitely something, part of the process that within operations as a whole, we're trying to formalize a little more. And especially because this village has so many little idiosyncrasies in all of its systems, there's machinery around the village that I know that this machine doesn't work exactly how it's supposed to, but I know how it does work, so I can continue to make it limp along and do what we need it to do, even though it's not working perfectly. That said, our turnover files for the really basic core functions of the job are really excellent. And I spent my first 2 months on the job reading as much as I possibly could of the old turnover files and getting really familiar with the documentation that we do have.
I think we're covering most of it. What do you think about doing a brief talk of the areas that you walk people through in the ops tour?
Yeah. Anytime that I've done ops tours, I've basically just taken guests out on rounds with me.
Okay.
It's kind of the most convenient way for me to show everybody the things that they tend to be interested in. Most people are really just in it to see the hydro generators. Seeing a generator in action is not an experience that a lot of folks get. So that's what most people are excited to do, is just go into our hydro building. I'll let people wander around and see the large magnets spinning inside of some coils of wire. And then most of the time, I'll leave it as an option for people to come with me to go up to the water treatment plant as well. Generally, at that point, about 80% of the tour is like, cool, we're done, and heads back to the village. But you always get one or two really enthusiastic people who are like, yeah, I would love to see the water treatment plant, which admittedly is not tremendously exciting. I can't blame folks for dropping off the tour at that point, because our water treatment plant is basically, the simplest description I can give of it is, we have 8 metal cylinders that have filters in them that we pump water through that filters out everything from dirt to Giardia from our water supply. And then once it's past the filters, it is hooked up to a chlorine pump that meters out a specific amount of chlorine into the water supply, and then it all gets run back up to the reservoir, and that's our water treatment process.
Green tank at the third level?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, okay. That's our reservoir. Yeah, that's kind of what the ops tour would look like. It's a lot of getting to look at different machinery and infrastructure that you don't normally get to see. I have offered to take people on a tour of the septic tank too, which is another large part of my job. We have 2 septic tanks. They're both behind Narnia, kind of in series. And then from there, the septic tank, within the tank, it separates out layers. So you have the sludge layer at the bottom, the water layer or the supernant layer in the middle, and then a scum layer. So the sludge at the bottom and the scum at the top are solids, right. Things that you don't really want to pump out to the drain field.
Got it.
At the end of the septic tank, we have filters and a setup so that it's really mostly just the water that's left over that gets pumped out to... We have two drain fields. There's one out by the labyrinth, which is the older of the two drain fields. And then we have another one that's out by 10 Mile. And okay. We can... Like, switching between those two is just a process of turning a couple of valves. But that just allows us to let one drain field rest while we use the other one. As much as we try to keep out, I mean, all of the scraping that people do in the dining hall, scraping plates, things like that, the goal behind all of that is to keep as much, mostly oil and grease, out of our effluent as possible. Anything like that that gets flushed down into the sewer system will ultimately clog our drain field. It makes it so that the soil can't take up as much.
So that doesn't turn into a solid, but it goes out with the fluid.
Okay. Yeah. I was testing that this morning, just go into the septic tank. We send out water samples of our effluent to see how much oil and grease are we putting into our drain field, because we have permits for that as well.
What about the life of the drain field? There's been talk that there's a need in the future to get a new one, and it's going to cost $1 million.
Again, those sorts of conversations are another one that are above my pay grade.
Sure. Yeah, totally.
It is possible that we will need a new drain field at some point, and that's why we cycle between the two drain fields. That's why we let them rest, is that we're kind of prolonging the life of the fields that we have. Over time, the things that you flush out there, those like oils and greases that I was talking about, bacteria in the soil will ultimately degrade those and allow the drain field to be used again. It just takes a very long time. That's something that will probably just require more monitoring and like testing, just to make sure that our drain fields are behaving as they're supposed to, that they're actually like trapping the water that we're sending out there. So from my standpoint, what that ends up looking like is just going out to the drain fields every week or so just to look and make sure that they're behaving as they should, that there isn't any effluent like surfacing or spewing out.
You've got how much time left in your contract? Talked about some things that you're looking forward to working on more or learning about.
Yeah. So I've got about 10 months left in my contract. I have like a pet project that I don't know if I'll be able to make it happen in the time that I'm here, but it's something that I am really excited about and see potential for in the village. It's like a concept that got me into environmental engineering in the first place, just because of an internship that I was doing prior to my master's program. And it's just something that I think is cool, which is building what's called an anaerobic digester. The basic idea is that we could take our compost and a lot of our waste streams and put them in a tank that has been engineered in such a way that we could continue to get usable compost out of it as solids and like compost tea as a liquid, but also could generate methane from it. If you engineer the biology within that tank well enough and have it set up in such a way that you can pump gases out of the tank, you can get usable methane from all of your waste. There are so many details to where do we put it, how do we control the inevitable stench that comes off of it, that sort of thing, that make it, again, a little bit of a pipe dream. During the summer, our current compost system is overloaded. Like when we have a full guest season, the compost bins that we have up at Garbo can't handle the capacity. They're supposed to sit for longer than they can because we're generating so much compost. It would just give us another place to put compost and use it effectively. Also, we could use methane that we were generating from our waste in place of propane that we use in the kitchens. Like, you can rig it up such that you're burning methane on your stove rather than propane, but it would be fuel that we had generated on site and that we were getting off of recycled products.
Back to the septic, where I know, unfortunately, the solids have to be pumped out. Isn't that an annual thing? And where does that go?
Yeah. I haven't gotten to do that yet, unfortunately. I have heard about it. It sounds like it's going to be quite the entertaining process.
August did it last time, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was 2 summers ago now. So it doesn't have to be annually. It definitely depends on how much waste we're generating. We have a contraption that August and Greg Armstrong fabricated called the Super Pooper, which is a large pump tank contraption. We pump all of the solids out of our septic tank into the Super Pooper tank. And then we take it down the road to Dan's camp, which is like our wood storage area. Mm-hmm. And the Forest Service, in coordination with the Department of Ecology, I believe, has a test site down there where they're comparing the effects of septage application to tree growth.
Okay.
So we have about a 1 acre plot where we are allowed to spray all of our solids. And that's the part that gets really entertaining, is you get to stand up on a hill with like a poop cannon. You're just like spraying septage out over this hill with a 2-3 inch PVC pipe hooked up to this giant pump. Yeah.
In the hopes that the trees will grow better.
Yeah.
Fertilized. Yeah. Okay. Did you hear anything about the Jerusalem artichoke story?
I have heard a little bit about it.
Just that it was approved, but ultimately they went with a traditional drain field. But
yeah.
The effluent was being pumped up and they did have a short growing season. And then the artichokes weren't used for eating, but could be turned to ethanol somehow.
Oh, wacky. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things in terms of having energy in the village be a little bit more sustainable in the long run.
And I mean, pumping our own septage is as much a cost thing as it is a sustainability thing. If we didn't do it ourselves, we would need to barge someone up here with a pump. They would need to pump our septic tanks and then haul all of our waste down lake again to apply
somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
good.
Very
that we have
expensive
that partnership and Forest Service that are studying.
Yeah, definitely. Our septic tank was designed to need pumping every 5 years, which I think was a liberal estimate for our peak seasons. It's not really a problem with our current situation.
Holden is always a place that you can't just go down and get help from somebody else.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful that there are people like you that have the energy to keep pressing forward and trying to solve the problem.
Yeah. And we are definitely very fortunate to have a lot of folks down lake who are there and available to support.
So who have you called?
Depending on the problem, Rich Wilson is a great asset for a lot of the power management stuff. He was the one who designed the whole load control system. If anything goes wrong with that, he's the first person we call if we can't figure out what's wrong with it. Just recently, we had an issue where the penstock, the major artery of water that supplies all of the village's water and for both drinking and for power, the penstock had sprung a leak. Yeah. We had to... I mean, we called in help from a lot of places for that project. We were borrowing machinery from IMCO to dig it up because we don't have a functional excavator.
Yep.
We called in Greg Armstrong and Charlie Dixon, who are both great resources. Charlie is a plumber who was involved in installing the penstock in the first place. Mm-hmm. Greg is just a fabrication wizard, really good at welding. He built the Super Pooper. And then was helping us to fabricate new parts for the penstock. I'm not sure this place could run without some of the outside support that we have. Mark Arby used to say, this place functions on the goodwill of very well-intentioned volunteers, which is great, but well-intentioned volunteers are not necessarily experts. And it's very good that we do have some experts on the bench that we can call in.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.